A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Lacazette! Il n'y a que lui! Alexandre Lacazette! Ødegaard, oh bien joué, oui. La passe aveugle avec Chambers. Oh, Johnson contre son corps.
Aïe, 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 aïe.
Cette mise sur le banc.
Oui, magnifique.
Qui a besoin de voir le blanc. La gâchette, Alexandre Lacazette.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
No,
too,
hang
Andrew.
On. Sorry. Let me take that back. Bad morning at first, but yeah. Then good morning.
In protest, the first third of this podcast is going to be absolutely atrocious. And then after that, we're going to really pick it up and end on a real high.
Yeah, exactly. And then spurn a chance to make it the best podcast of all time right at the end. How about that?
yeah. What a weird game that was.
It was. And trying to detach myself very slightly from it from, you know, an Arsenal perspective, I couldn't help but wonder if it was a game that was in some ways very much a game from this season, if you like. You know what I mean?
Maybe. I feel like it was a darn sight more entertaining than a lot of the other games I've seen this season. But
yeah, just the craziness. Well, I'm sure it was entertaining for the neutral, whoever that guy is, and we know we don't like that guy. I mean, he's
screw
neutral. Take a position, man. But, you know, I see it would be entertaining. If you were just sitting there and you were watching a game of football between two teams you don't support, that would have been great fun. But, you know, obviously our perspective on it is quite different. But I do think it, you know, there was something about that game and what happened and how it happened and everything else that felt a bit like, this is another mad thing that's happened over the last while, so let's kind of roll with it.
Yeah, I saw as well, it was kind of one of those where the comeback, as exciting as it was, it does lack something without kind of the fans in the away end, doesn't it, celebrating the late equaliser.
Exactly, or even the fans, the home fans, shitting themselves. To be fair, Jamie Carragher did his best, didn't he, on the co-commentary to start making weird noises towards the end, like when Declan Rice went on that run towards the Arsenal goal, he was like, you know, those kind of sounds. Which
I was making that noise at home as well, actually. I have to be honest, on my sofa, exactly the same.
My noises came out of the other end, so we won't go there.
Fair enough. It was, I guess, a bit emblematic of this weird season, but I think it was kind of a microcosm of Arsenal all in the space of 90 minutes. You know, our inconsistencies and our deficiencies and our strengths all apparent within the space of the same game. There was a lot to take in.
There sure was. The good, the bad and the ugly, I guess you would say. Or two faces, as Mikel Arteta said afterwards. We have two faces. Mm. Somebody said to me on Twitter that maybe he was saying there were two phases in the game, which could be equally applicable, but two faces seems to be much better. It is like, like the variance between how good we can be and how bad we can be is enormous, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is quite extraordinary. And how quickly it can seem to veer between the two. I'm almost at a loss for what to say about it because it is so, it's an extraordinary capacity we have. And I guess if you can be really good and you can be really bad, where you end up is pretty much bang in the middle. And that's where we are.
Yeah, you've got to get rid of the bad as much as possible, or certainly do less of the bad and do more of the good. But that's an issue involving consistency and things that we've discussed time and time again on this
particular podcast.
I think our last
nine league games, sorry, I'm just fiddling with my headphones, but I think our last nine league games have seen us win three, draw three and lose three.
Yeah.
And then we went three down and came back by three. I mean, we are the most odd of teams.
Three is the magic number, as De La Soul
for us
once
it seems
said.
To be.
Yeah, it's not that magic though. It could be, you know, more magic. Maybe we need to get a different magic number. So, you know, from those nine, nine of them are wins. Maybe nine could be.
If nine was our magic number, probably lose 9-0. But all right. Let's not worry about that.
Right, let's go from the start and the team selection. Emile Smith Rowe not 100% fit, according to Martin Tyler in the commentary. Mm-hmm. So that's why he didn't start. But the deployment of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang on the right and Bukayo Saka on the left from the first whistle was odd to me. Can you think of a reason why Mikel Arteta chose to do that, given that it has very rarely, if ever, worked with Aubameyang on the right-hand side? I mean, the argument could be that with Callum Chambers in the side at right-back to give us a bit more, presence, because West Ham, as we know, are very good in the air and very good from set pieces, to sort of add a bit more dynamism to that right-hand side, you put in Aubameyang. You know, I'm actually stretching here to think of a reason why that might be the case. I mean, you don't put Aubameyang on the wing for his defensive work in particular, do you? Arteta said afterwards that, like, well, the reason we played him there, you know, we had a good reason, but we didn't play well. And we didn't, you know, do the game as well as we should have. Therefore, we couldn't, you know, get the best out of him in that position, et cetera, et cetera. But I just think that's a bad decision.
Do you know what? I think it's a little bit tricky because I don't think it's the reason we conceded the goals that we did.
No, I agree with you there.
And so sort of to an extent, whatever that plan was, and I can only assume, you know, West Ham, they have slightly lopsided fullbacks, a bit like us. You know, Cresswell is the one who gets forward on the left-hand side, Kufau less so. Mm. And I guess they were thinking, maybe Aubameyang can exploit that space in behind or can pin him back in some way.
Yeah.
That would be my best guess, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, it didn't work at all. You look at it now and you say, well, it was the wrong decision. But I kind of feel like it probably wouldn't have worked, but it also kind of never got a chance to, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I get it. But then people will say that you don't give yourself the best opportunity to control the game the way you want, you know, by picking a player out of position. Maybe is harsh because he has played there before, but in a position where
he's never really played well there.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. So you're putting yourself at a disadvantage, even if your plan is, like you say, exploit the space that Cresswell leaves behind. Mm. I mean, I think what was obvious in that first 15, 20 minutes when he was on the right-hand side is that Cresswell had pretty much all the joy that he had in the game during that period. And when Saka went over there, he was much less effective.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So didn't work.
It didn't work. And I suppose one of my issues with this game is that, like, the selection, I thought, was you know, it's with hindsight, you look at the team selection, you say, well, that didn't help. You know, we had a really dreadful start. But then we came back into the game very strongly with effectively the same 11 players.
Yeah.
So I don't want to ascribe it all to that. Do you know what I mean?
No, I know. It is difficult to try and get your head around why exactly there was such variance between the two levels of performance.
Yeah. And there are small things, like, I think you're right, Aubameyang being out on the right didn't help us because, you know, not only does he not give you a lot defensively, he's also just not very comfortable there going forward. You know, maybe rotating in Pablo Mari disturbed the balance at centre-half. You know, we made changes to the back four and it was a ragged line at times.
Yeah. I mean, those two selections, Chambers and Pablo Mari, clearly there for their presence, their size, their height. Pablo Mari, of course, is, you know, the biggest central defender that we have. So dealing with the aerial threat that West Ham have and Suchek and everything else, you could see the rationale behind those selections. Mm-hmm. Whether they were effective in terms of stopping West Ham being a threat, that's another thing. Because, you know, I don't think Louise and Marie really dovetailed particularly well. It looked to me that there was a bit of, not tension, but like Louise had a few of those moments, didn't he, where he kind of looks unhappy at what his partner is doing, even if his partner is just playing him a simple pass. You know, he has those kind of games. And I think it didn't really work because Souček was dangerous and obviously they scored from an aerial position as well. So, yeah, you can see the reasons why selections were made and changes were made and some rotation was put in place. But, look, it didn't work. Those first 30, 32 minutes were as bad as anything we've produced under Arteta.
Definitely. And ultimately, you know, the manager has to be responsible for that. But I think, without wishing to kind of absolve him, I do think that this was about much more than kind of the names on the team sheet. And I think that the performance level of the whole team was just not there. They just weren't at the races, to use a cliche.
Europa League hangover, lapse concentration, whatever it might be. I mean, it is kind of inexplicable, isn't it? Because, you know, all the Oh, maybe it's not inexplicable, but, you know, all the pre-game talk, I'm sure, would have been about, you know, let's start strongly. We do have those European minutes under our belt during the week or in our legs, so maybe just sit in, keep it tight for first 15, 20 minutes and then grow into the game. Like, I wasn't surprised that we started relatively slowly, given, you know, what we've done in the last few weeks with the two Olympiacos games and the Spurs game.
No, nor I. And I think West Ham, you know, they were aware of, they'd had a week to prepare for this game since the match at Old Trafford, and they were aware of the schedule we faced, and they, you know, they were looking, I mean, what happened with the quick free kick, they were looking to do that from the first whistle. They were taking throw-ons quickly, they were taking free kicks quickly. I think they sensed maybe that Arsenal would be looking to kind of feel their way into the game, and they exploited that very well. They were very predatory on that. But, you know, a lot of these players have had rests at various stages in this intense period. And it just felt like the intensity simply wasn't there. I mean, David Luiz, it's often said of him, you can tell very early on what sort of David Luiz you're going to get in the course of a game. And, you know, I thought we learned, I thought he was way off the pace from the first whistle, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree. I thought he grew into the game quite well and defended quite bravely in the second half. But that's true of everybody. And I don't know how much you can expect from a 33, nearly 34-year-old central defender. You know, he's played a lot of late. He really has played a lot of late, and you can see that that's in his legs. And I'm not making excuses for poor performance or anything, but that's an issue the manager has to deal with, and maybe something we can chat about a bit later on. Let's do the goals. First one, I mean, it's a good goal, I guess, but you can always look at a goal and see we could have done a bit more there. We could have, you know, could Louise have closed down Antonio better? Could Pablo Marie have stayed a bit more towards the edge of the box to block off Lingard? Chambers couldn't get there in time, etc., etc. But a good strike. Do you have any major issue with that goal?
I think Louise, you know, he gets dragged out into the channel and he gets beat, basically. I mean, you know, he backs off and backs off, allowing the guy to pull it back for Lingard. From that point on, it's a really good finish, and of course we should have expected it. Jesse Lingard has a sort of nasty habit of scoring goals against Arsenal. It seems to me, anyway, maybe I just because I have an irrational... No, actually, a very rational dislike of Jesse Lingard.
Yes.
I notice them more. But it is a really good strike from him, and I suppose we can't ask too many questions on that front, but I did feel that we were quite passive in the way that we defended in the build-up.
I think both central defenders were poor for the first goal. But, you know,
the second goal, obviously, you know, I had more grievances.
So, on the, it's a disgrace that the free kick was taken from a, you know, different position than the offense was committed in, point of view. Where do you stand on that one? Like, in terms of that being an issue worth discussing, to me, it's fucking irrelevant, to be honest.
Do you know what? I have to confess, I had to check out what exactly the law is, because it does feel like 90% of the time the referee won't let you take a free kick until he's blown a second whistle for it. But apparently that's at the referee's discretion. He determines if... I forget what the phrasing of it is exactly, but, you know, he can say, you can't take this until my whistle. And if he doesn't, then it's within the player's control for an indirect free kick.
Look, I think some of the decisions that John Moss made yesterday were to our benefit. You think about, was it the third goal that we took a quick free kick ourselves?
Yeah.
When West Ham were looking for a... they were looking for a foul in midfield. And look, John Moss never going to be my favourite guy, but to me it's absolutely pointless discussing the fact that a free kick was taken from not the position that the foul was taken in, but it was further away from the goal. So it's not as if they gained an advantage in terms of you know, distance to our goal or anything like that. If it was 5 yards further forward, of course you might have a little bit of an issue with that. The issue is that the Arsenal players, to a man basically, all switched off when that free kick was given. Saka was arguing with the referee. Saka turns away. Pablo Marie turns away. Kieran Tierney turns away. Pablo Marie turns away. Bernd Leno turns away. David Luiz is looking at the ball, you know, but he's too far away to do anything about it. West Ham were opportunistic and smart, and they were rewarded for it. We were punished for it, you know, for just... ridiculous lack of concentration and awareness that at this level, I mean, they kept saying it on the TV, didn't they? It's schoolboy stuff, schoolboy error, schoolboy. It's the first thing you're taught is never turn your back on the ball, blah, blah, blah. I mean, we all know that. And that's why, to me, there's just no point whatsoever in talking about the referee or, you know, the quick free kick or anything like that. Don't bemoan a refereeing decision or lack of decision when your players could very easily have stopped the danger there just by being aware, just by concentrating. It's a terrible lack of concentration by not one, but basically four or five players, and it cost us. So that's where people should be pissed off, not at the referee.
It is almost the entire team. And I did see some people saying, well, the referee's getting out the spray, you know, to set up the wall. But
so what?
If the player's attention was on the referee, that would make some sense, but it's not. Yeah. They're all just literally switched off, you know, and it's really, really, really sloppy. I think I said on Twitter it's unprofessional, and I think it is. You know, they just weren't focused in that moment. And Bernd Leno sort of flickers like a hologram, doesn't he, as the shot goes in at the near post.
It looks bad for him, and it is bad, but I also think he is slightly unlucky in that it takes a deflection off Pablo Mari. And it's quite close, you know?
If you have a look at the shot... But shouldn't he be guarding that post anyway?
No, I'm sure. I'm not... I just think it's not a... Is it a goalkeeping error? Maybe it is, to be beaten at your near post. It's one of those things. You should never be beaten at your near post, even though goalkeepers are beaten at their near
post.
It's
just, you know, Almunia trauma for me.
I get it. I just think the only thing I'm saying is that it was made more difficult because of the deflection off Pablo Marie, who's like 3 or 4 yards out, or maybe a little bit more than that. But, you know, it takes a deflection off him. I mean, we saw what a small deflection can do when Lacazette, in inverted commas, scored just before halftime. So, you know, it is a factor in that ball going in, which isn't to say that Leno covered himself in glory or anything like it.
Yeah, that's fair. I hadn't actually noticed that on the first couple of watches, but you're right. It does take a nick. But I'm still looking at the keeper. I think he needs to do a bit better.
Yeah, I agree. I was just, you know, laying out the full facts here, you know.
Yeah.
Third goal. Arteta was furious about the second two goals. Absolutely unacceptable, I think, is what he said about the second and third goals. What part of the third goal do you think will have frustrated him the most?
Good question, because there's a few things. I mean, there's Leno's pass out to Tierney, right? Which sort of starts it all off, which is a difficult one to control. Then Tierney quite casual, I suppose, volleying it back in field. So there's the concession of possession, which is pretty bad. I think it's going to be probably one of those two, although I would say... Aubameyang could do a lot more to help Kieran Tierney out.
That he could. And I think that when Arteta looks back at it, you know, the other things are not great, but they're just sort of part and parcel of football in a way. You know, you make a casual pass or your goalkeeper puts you in a bit of trouble, or you don't win a header in the box against, you know, a player like Antonio, who is really good in the air. He's so strong, you know, so being beaten to a header is not great for a central defender, but it happens. It's not an egregious mistake. I think when Arteta looks back on that goal, and he analyzes it with more camera angles than we have, because I've watched it and we don't quite get to see the wide angle, but I'm pretty sure that Aubameyang could do an awful lot more to close down the guy who crosses the ball for the header.
Yeah, he switches off a little bit when the ball comes back to Koufal. And I don't have any issues with David Luiz on that one, just because Antonio is so good in the air and he does have a bit of a run on him. You know, I think he's always second favourite there, Luiz. But yeah, I mean, it's another goal that kind of comes from, I suppose, a bit of a playing out from the back error.
Mm.
And yeah, Aubameyang should probably do a little bit more. I mean, again, maybe that's sort of incurred a little bit by the fact he starts on the right and then switches to the left, and he's not quite as aware of his responsibilities as he should be on that side.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, but he's plenty aware of his responsibility on the left-hand side because he's played there time to time. Oh, there is another angle. Yeah, I'm just watching another angle of it here. He really could do an awful lot more. He just kind of switches off and lets the number five... off. Who's the number five? The Koufal.
Koufal.
You know, and he really could do an awful lot better. I'm wondering as well, is there someone who could... I mean, I think that was that going in, whether it hit Suchek or not?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. I actually couldn't tell what had happened at first. And the way that Antonio, you could see him saying Suchek. And I thought he was saying check for VAR. I thought he was like, oh, maybe, you know, it might be given offside.
Mm.
Maybe it's not going in, but, you know, we got a big break of our own with the goal that got us back into the game.
Yeah, I'm just looking. I mean, it might well have been going in. I don't think Leno was getting there anyway.
I mean, Antonio is sort of a bit of a kryptonite player, for this Arsenal team. You know, he is a handful, but the way our back four played in the first half hour, I think made him look significantly better than he is.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so look... 3-0 down, and you're thinking, what the fuck? And I was genuinely a bit worried that it might get worse.
Same.
You know,
2-0, I thought this could be like 4 or 5.
Mm.
I really thought we were that bad in the opening period.
You know, at 2-0, I was thinking, well, if we get one, you know, there's a long time to go. If we get one, then, you know, it's only a one-goal game. And I was thinking... as the ball came out to Callum Chambers at one point, I was going, this, you know, I know why Chambers was picked for this game from a defensive perspective.
Yeah.
Are we going to have to make a change at right back, which is not ideal when you need to score 3 goals, right? You're thinking, well, mm-hmm. that's a bit counterintuitive, making a change at right back. But just to give you, you know, Cedric was on the bench. He's maybe a bit more traditional in terms of a fullback and what you might expect, and somebody who could get up and down and get deliveries in. And we know that, you know, his set piece delivery and his crossing is pretty good. I did not see that coming from Callum Chambers. Did not see it coming.
No. And it was an important outlet for Arsenal in the whole game, wasn't it? Him getting forward in that way. And his delivery was good.
It was great. I mean, it's the power and pace and, you know, the timing of it and not taking extra touches and you know, putting the ball in the right area. He did it more than once, obviously. You know, the own goal is a great example of what happens when the quality of your delivery is too good for a defense to deal with, even if one of your attacking players can't get there. But more than once, he put the ball in and Fabianski had some difficulties dealing with it.
That's right.
You know, defensively as well, I think one of the things that's overlooked in the game is that Chambers made 8 clearances, which is more than any other Arsenal player. So he didn't just do it at one end of the pitch. It was a hell of a performance from him because you know, he kind of sparked into life a bit, and Arsenal sparked into life a bit, you know, on the 40-minute mark, whatever it was. But yeah. Chambers' performance was really, really good at both ends. He deserves a lot of credit for coming into the team after being out for so long and maybe not being the ideal guy, at least on paper, for the position that we found ourselves in. To be 3-0 down, you're looking for as much attacking prowess as you can get, and that's not necessarily something that you would associate with Callum Chambers. So,
like you say, I don't think it was the reason he was picked, you know.
No.
I do think that was probably for his height, but it was a really good performance. Sky gave him man of the match. I think, for me, Odegaard was our best player. And I do think he really helps whoever plays at right back because of his natural tendency to drift to that side, and he's got the timing of the pass to play players in on that flank. Credit to Lacazette as well. I know, obviously, it takes a significant deflection on the way through, but it's a nice touch to set up the shot.
It is good touch, turn and shoot. And, you know, it is kind of unfortunate for him that goes down as an own goal. It feels very nitpicky in a way that it's credited as an own goal, because Lacazette's work there was excellent, you know. And I think he was, you know, that's the best game he's had for us in a long time. That was a really influential performance from Lacazette, because when you look at what he was involved in, there was that moment after he again, in inverted commas, scored the goal to make it 3-1. He played Saka through with a lovely ball in behind. I think Saka should score there. I think he's got to score. You know, took the wrong option.
I wondered if he picked the wrong side.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It felt like that to me. And actually, this is... Saka, I mean, has been fantastic, obviously, for the vast majority of the season. I do think if there is an area he might improve, it might be his finishing. There have been quite a few instances in the last several months where he's had chances I've thought, oh, he could do better there. Or he's had a few near misses, should we say.
Yeah, for sure.
And I'm sure he's got the potential, because he scored goals very regularly at youth level, and we've seen him finish really well on some occasions. I just think that consistency in his finishing is still to come.
I mean, that could have been 3-2, probably should have been 3-2 before halftime, which would have been astonishing scoreline, given...
I love the pass from Lacazette, by the way, in the build-up.
It's really, nice, really good, yeah. So, and there was another moment as well, I think, just before the break, where Saka... It could have been Tierney cross, and Saka was there, and his shot just deflected off someone and squirted just wide of the post. So, you know, from that moment on, from the moment the goal went in, the momentum changed. And that can happen, of course, when you're 3-0 up and you're protecting a lead and everything else. But, you know, I think you have to give... as bad as we were, and there's no question we were bad, and you can be as critical as you want to be for that, and rightly so. You know, the only reason we showed character was because we showed brittleness to go 3-0 behind, etc., you know. Mm-hmm. But we really did respond in a terrific way. Like I said, could have been 3-2 very early in the first half. I think, was it Callum Chambers with a little kind of stab pass over the top of the defence?
It was outside of the foot from Chambers, which he's used to good effect before. Do you remember a great goal he scored with the outside of his boot at the Emirates Stadium?
Yes, I do, actually. Was it Burnley or someone like that?
Burnley or Stoke, someone like that, you know. And that was a brilliant pass too. I think Lacazette sort of does the right thing. You know, lifts it over the keeper. Do you think he should score there?
Look, I think he has to try and score. I saw people talking about, look, because he got a tug. There was no question he got a tug. And
oh, yeah, for sure.
If he'd gone down, would that have been... I mean, it was outside the box.
That's a red card if he goes down.
It was outside the box, but I wonder would it have been, or could it have been a red card by the letter of the law?
You'd be screaming for it as an Arsenal fan.
I guess so, but I think... Really, I want my striker to try and score a goal there, you know. And it was cleared off the line. It was a great piece of defending by Diop,
yeah. It is such a good pass from Chambers. I'm just watching it back now. I mean, you know, I think we do forget about him. He has got a good technical level and has played central midfield, so he can pass the ball well.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's an excellent one. And actually, not that commoner sight to see Lacazette going in behind. He sort of did it well by going both directions yesterday. He was dropping off very, very well, but was also a threat in the penalty box.
So, yeah, I mean, look, it wasn't all one-way traffic in fairness, because West Ham had an amazing chance to make it 4-2. Again, I don't think Pablo Marie was particularly good against Benrahma, and Antonio on the stretch puts the ball against the post from, what, 2 yards out?
Have we done our second goal yet? Is this after our second goal?
Well, we talked about Chambers, the delivery, didn't we? I mean, does Martin Odegaard have the pre-assist for each goal?
He does, yeah.
You know, and he's... Oh, God, I love him already. I really do. I just love watching him. He's just the kind of player I love to watch. He's got so much ability, but I really like his character and his personality. This is a guy who's on loan here, you know, and he's playing like it means everything to him. And the club and the shirt and the badge and all the things you want to say. You know, he's... Arteta praised his leadership, didn't he, before...
Yeah.
Before the game, the Norwegian journalists always ask about him, and he always tries to say the same thing, but in a slightly different way. You know, but you can see why he loves him. And even when we were playing really badly, Odegaard was the one Arsenal player, I think, who really stood out in terms of what he was trying to do, who didn't let his head go down, who kept trying to play, you know, he's just... Yeah. A joy to watch. I love watching him in an Arsenal.
I thought he had a really good cameo in the Europa League as well. Yeah. I thought he was, you know, one of the players who emerged with some credit from that game. This is the goal where we took quite a quick free kick, actually, and benefited from it. And Odegaard's most common pass in the game was Chambers.
Yeah.
So that combination on our right-hand side was really important.
Yeah. So...
It would have been interesting to see what happened if Dawson misses that. You know, does Aubameyang get there? Does he put it in the day he was having?
But, you don't know, but I mean, it's a moot point, I guess. Who knows? Who knows?
Good delivery, though, for Chambers.
Yeah, I mean, really good.
Defender into a decision.
Really good. You know, it's one of those things as a central defender that you just can't do much about, you know?
So, no.
I mean, down to the quality of the delivery from Chambers, he deserves a lot of credit for that.
And just to say, like on both our first and second goals, you'll notice that, you know, Odegaard's involved on the right-hand side, but Bukayo Saka's involved in those moves as well. Mm. And, you know, that is another argument for, you know, saying why did Aubameyang start on that wing? You know, when you've got Saka, who's maybe got some relationships developing on that flank, why not lean into that?
So
3-2. And then 3-2. Did you... At that point, are you thinking we're going to do this?
Well, I mean, I wasn't confident that we were going to not concede.
Right,
I didn't.
Yeah.
It didn't seem implausible to me that we would score again, even though we're not great at scoring late. But we had players on the pitch who could score goals, you know. Mm-hmm. And we did make changes. Smith Rowe came on for Xhaka, which was interesting, and then Pepe on for Bukayo Saka. So, you know, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that with those players on the pitch, Lacazette, Aubameyang, Odegaard, Pepe, Smith Rowe, then Martinelli on for Aubameyang, that you could score a goal. My issue, my worry, I suppose, was that we would concede another one. And there were dangerous moments. We talked about Antonio hitting the post. There was a really, really good block by Kieran Tierney. Which was excellent. There was the Declan Rice one where he like an ent on speed just fucking
strides through the midfield.
Yeah, it was like stop him. I could see where this is. Just stop him. Just trip him up. It was one
I
of
mean,
those.
How they don't score on the Antonio one? It's quite incredible, isn't it? Benrahma, when he drives through and sort of has the cross shot. I mean, West Ham fans must feel absolutely sick to their stomach to not win this game.
I'm sure, like 3-0 up and you know...
They had real chances for the fourth goal.
Exactly. So, look, the equaliser, again, Odegaard to Pepe. I think the pass from Odegaard makes Pepe's mind up for him as to what he has to do. Because we know he doesn't really like using his right foot if he can help it.
Yeah.
You know? But the way the pass ran meant he had to take it on the run, and that's possibly the best thing he's ever done with his right foot for Arsenal. Oh, no, it's not. I'm thinking of a goal. That was the goal. Yeah.
The league where he rolled it out of his studs. Yeah. But second it is best an absolute thing. Peach of a cross.
It really is. And a good header, really good header from Lacazette to equalise. So.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, yeah, it's a nice header from Lacazette, but the cross really does put it, you know, on the plate for him. And I think the West Ham centre-halves just lose sight of Lacazette, to be honest. Yeah. They wouldn't be too happy with that. But I think we absolutely deserved it. You know, after that dreadful half hour, I felt like we really, really responded well.
Mm.
We might even have won it.
I think Pepe used up all his right foot juice on that cross because the opportunity that he had to make it 4-3, it's one of those where I just wonder if there was enough of a tug from the defender to slightly put him off.
Yeah.
Maybe not enough for a penalty, but enough to just distract him a little, you know?
And it does come to him on that foot. I do you know what? I actually wondered if he might have done slightly better with the other half chance, which doesn't look as presentable, but because it falls to his left foot. Do you know the one I mean? Where Tierney crosses it in and it drops 82nd minute, nearly the 83rd. Tierney crosses it in from the left-hand side, again from a Odegaard pass. He's just involved in absolutely everything we do in the game. And the ball comes to Pepe at the far stick. He brings it down on his chest. A normal player, I'd say that's not really much of a chance. But with a player with a left foot as good as his, I think he might have generated a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. Shot. Oh, yeah. Yes, I think you're right. I think you're right.
I actually think that might be a better chance for him than the other one.
That's a bit of a miskick, isn't it? It's a bit of a miskick.
The other one is a beautiful pass from Odegaard. You're making Jamie Carragher noises.
I mean, it reminded me of Cesc Fabregas, to be honest. It was that good, so that'll
tell
you. It was
a brilliant pass, but and a good run, to be fair, from Pepe. You know, he makes that diagonal movement.
In a similar position from which he scored against...
Southampton?
Could have been, yeah. Was it? Yeah, could have been.
When he's playing off the left-hand side, I think, and Xhaka finds him. I think that's the one.
Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of,
But, yeah, he takes it on his left. He has to hit it with his right. Does he get a little pull? I'm not sure.
But...
Yeah, enough to put him off the shot, but not enough for a penalty.
Yeah, I don't think it's a penalty. I think he, you know, probably could and should do a little bit better with the effort and maybe the two efforts that he had. But look, he did make a big contribution in terms of getting us a point from a game which looked for a long time like it was going to end much worse than it already did. So, I mean, where do you place this in the... the pantheon of this season? Is it just another example of our inconsistency, another example of what it is we need to do better and what we need to improve on? You know,
we can't keep writing off these kind of big defensive errors or as aberrations. Do you know what I mean? There's a clear established pattern of late, with us shooting ourselves in the foot, as we've said so many times. And you know, and ordinarily a 3-3 game like that, you might kind of set it to one side and say, wow, that was just a crazy 90 minutes of football, but it's not. It's a microcosm of what we're doing more generally. It's a really, really confusing time to be an Arsenal fan, I think. Because there are signs of progress which seem sort of undermined at every turn. It is genuinely difficult to get your head around, isn't it?
It is, because for every bit of encouragement that we have, you can't help but worry about some of the stuff that we saw yesterday. Because a lot of it is just basics. It's basics. Like, you know,
I was just going to say, it's not, you know, we've seen a lot of individual errors, and there were individual errors involved in the goals we conceded yesterday, but it was a collective malaise in that opening half hour. You know, yeah. I don't think you could just write it off as, oh, Granit Xhaka's brain fell out again. You know,
it
was a wider problem than that. I think it is a wider problem.
It is a wider problem. And, you know, there is encouragement to be taken from a situation where you play that badly. And look, you could see the interviews where the game ends and we've lost and the guys are saying, well, look, we've got to work harder on the training ground. We've got to put things right, et cetera, et cetera. They put it right before the end of the game. Even if we did ride our luck a little bit, they put it right before the end of the game. So that's good. But yeah. I don't know. You can't keep giving away goals the way we've been giving away goals. And whether it's individual or whether it's collective, there needs to be more security defensively than we've been seeing of late.
100%. And, you know, had we achieved this result in a different fashion, you know, a point against West Ham, given the season they're having and the season we're having, is not in itself a disastrous result. But just, it was shocking the mountain that we gave ourselves to climb. And if we continue to do that, we will not make sufficient progress. And all the good things that are definitely going on in this team will be for naught.
Yep. No, I agree. And I think the word you used earlier is absolutely correct. Undermined. You know, there are things to be encouraged about. There are things that I like about what we're doing and how we're trying to play. I think maybe we fell away from that a little bit yesterday in terms of how we set up the team. Maybe some of it was team selection was impacted by injury. You know, there was no Willian, which isn't something I'm going to cry about. But, you know, Smith Rowe not being 100%, not perhaps being ready to start, had an impact on the team selection in that, you know, he picked something different. He picked Lacazette up front. And I thought Lacazette, as I said, was really good yesterday. Had a very, very good game. But what's worked best over the last little while is those three technical players behind, you know, Aubameyang, even though he hasn't really been scoring. Although you could say behind a striker, I guess, because Lacazette.
There have been games it's worked well
with Lacazette. Yeah.
You think of Chelsea, West Brom, you know, was one of those players was Aubameyang, wasn't it, behind Lacazette. But there have been games where it's worked that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, had he been able to start Smith Rowe or Willian on that left-hand side, perhaps he would have done, and perhaps it would have been just one of Aubameyang or Lacazette in the starting 11.
It'd be interesting. It would have been interesting to see which one.
Yeah, I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, after the performance that Arsenal produced in the North London Derby, even though it was a very up and down game for Lacazette personally, you know, sticking with some of what worked on that day, you couldn't have necessarily argued with that.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting thing about the Aubameyang selection of him in the wide areas as well. I think you're right. For so long this season, Arsenal have kind of struggled. He had such a disappointing first half of the season, didn't he, Aubameyang? And then they found something that was working for him and for the team.
Yeah, and then it sort of wasn't working from an individual perspective for him because, you know, he had the bad night in front of goal against Benfica, bad night in front of goal against Olympiacos. I thought he was genuinely probably our worst player yesterday. Mm-hmm. And we do have some questions about Aubameyang, so I don't want to labour this particular point right now, but in terms of our collective performance, you know, we talked about these three technical players behind a striker, and what we did was we put a non-technical player in his least effective position.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like you said, it's not necessarily the reason why we conceded the goals that we did, but perhaps it was a reason as to why we weren't able to control the game the way we would like, or get into the game.
Once we swap them, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And I also just think that the point about the technical aspect is an important one. I mean, we've said it so many times about Aubameyang. If he's not getting on the end of stuff, there's only so much he can offer you. And it was a bit of a conundrum, I felt, for Mikel Arteta, because he wasn't contributing a huge amount in the game. I think he probably was our most disappointing player on the day. But there's always that temptation to leave him on because he might find that half yard of space in the penalty box that makes all the difference. I thought it was a brave call, actually, to bring him off, even though he was playing poorly.
I get that. I mean, it's one of those things where you're going, we need a goal, and taking off, you know, our best goal scorer, even though he hasn't been in great form or anything like it, but, you know, taking him off or taking a striker of that caliber off when you need a goal is not easy, even when he is playing as poorly as he played yesterday. And to be honest, I thought he was probably a bit lucky to last as long as he did.
Yeah.
You know, I understand why, as a manager, you're thinking, well, fuck, you know, we need a goal. Do I take the striker off?
Even if he's not playing? I think there's a dilemma there, isn't there?
It does. It causes a problem. You know, or it certainly gives you a decision to make.
Because, you know, it wasn't his day, but it's not been his day in the past, and he's just, you know, been in the right place at the right time to make the difference at times. So, yeah, I thought it was... I mean, I think it tells you quite how off his game he was, that he was brought off. Let's put it like that. Although still, maybe he was distracting defenders for that Lacazette header, because he can't have been far away from the pitch, can he? He was straight back on for the celebration.
What was I going to say? So, look, in conclusion to part one, a well-timed interlull?
Yeah. I think very much needed after the run of games we've had. And definitely some thinking to be done for Mikel Arteta. You know, when he analyses this period, there will be that kind of balance of things that have pleased him and satisfied him, and things that will have enormously frustrated him. So plenty of food for thought for this fortnight.
Yeah. Hopefully it gives him and his staff a chance to take stock and reassess and sort some shit out, because that shit really does need to be sorted out. You know, the length of time it's been since we've kept a clean sheet is too big. It's too big. So some thinking to do. So look, let's take a break right here, and we will come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two, where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at GunnerBlog and at ArsBlog, also on the ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon. I am going to start today, James.
Okay.
If you don't mind. And okay. This one comes from Philip Anastasi on Twitter, who is at leftover_crumbs. And he said, nearly 8 months into the season and we don't have a settled centre-back pairing. Do you think this is holding us back from ironing out those ridiculous errors in every first half we play?
I don't want to be a hypocrite here, because I think in recent weeks I've sort of said that there's a benefit to the fact that there's, you know, the ability to rotate at centre half. And I think in this season particularly, maybe more than any other ever before, there is a need to chop and change the starting 11. However, there is the old maxim, isn't there, about kind of playing a consistent back four in order to iron out errors. I actually would say that I consider the error here probably under-rotating, in that I think David Luiz has probably been asked to play too many games, and I don't quite understand the reluctance to use maybe Rob Holding, for example. He's been a bit reticent to play him of late, and I think, you know, Luiz does give you a lot in his passing, and I thought in the second half his passing was really important to helping Arsenal progress the ball. But if playing David Luiz is like playing Russian roulette, we've pulled the trigger a lot recently, you know?
Yeah.
And sooner or later it catches up with you. So I think in an ordinary season, I'd like to see a settled centre-half partnership. I understand why that isn't the case this season. And I think maybe we've asked a little bit too much of Luiz. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. I sort of agree with the question, but sort of broadening it out, I think what's really clear is that the right-sided centre half is an important position for us to get right for next season. You know, Luiz and his passing on his day is excellent. Only completed 2 of 7 long balls yesterday, though, so that element to his game wasn't as good as it can be. Like I said, I think he grew into the game. I think he defended bravely a couple of times in the second half. He went on his own little rampage forward, didn't he, before he was crudely hacked down by Antonio, and then went up for a free kick, and he looked exhausted. I mean, the man looks absolutely exhausted. He terrifies me. I can't lie about that. The sense that I have that at any moment he could make an error never leaves me. I think he has played well of late, you know, for the most part. But I think the issue for me is that if we acknowledge that Gabriel is probably the first choice and should be the first choice left center half, we have to find that player for the right for next season, because it's not Rob Holding for me, who I think can be a decent squad option, but not the starting center half in a team which wants to make real progress. Right? And that's not to be dismissive of
I don't
of
think
him.
That either, by the way. I was only saying that as a rotation.
No. I get it. I just think that as a squad option, Rob Holding is good. He's the right sort of age. He's English.
Right sort of personality, to be honest.
I think he gives us some squad depth, but I don't think he can be the starting centre half if we want the team to make the kind of progress that we wanted to make. Nor can David Luiz next season, in my opinion. You know, he already looks like a player whose legs are beginning to sing a little. You know what I mean? He's going to be 34 next month. How much more can you get out of him, really? What more can he give you? So for me, what we do for next season in the right center half position is going to be really important as to how we develop this team and what kind of a player we have in that position, and whether it's William Saliba or whether it's somebody else, if we don't upgrade there in order to maintain some kind of consistency at center half, then I think we're going to find it difficult to be as defensively solid as Mikel Arteta and everyone listening to this wants us to be.
The Luiz one is really interesting. You know, what are they going to do about his contractual situation? Tim Steelman wrote a good piece for Arseblog, didn't he?
Yeah.
Sort of saying he thinks he'll get a new deal. I think there's every chance, you know, that he might. If it was in my hands, I would really, really be leaning into using Saliba. I just think there's not going to be a vast amount of money available this summer Arsenal to go and do business in the market. And I've got a question in a minute about a player they might want to buy permanently that probably wouldn't come very cheap. And if you've got someone on the books
who you've already paid £28 million for,
you've got to try and give that a go.
Yeah, I agree.
I just think it would be crazy not to. But, you know, we've had that debate before. So, this is my question that I was going to ask you.
Uh-huh.
No surprises what it's about. It's from Boom Shakalaka on the Discord. And they ask, how much would you be willing to pay for Odegaard? And do you have any concerns that will be priced out of buying him if he continues to play this well?
That is the double-edged sword, isn't it? You know, when you bring in a player on loan who plays really, really well, ultimately the beneficiary is the club that owns him. Like, okay, he's going to give us plenty on the pitch, and I think what he can give us between now and May, we need to sit back and enjoy and everything else and keep fingers crossed. But ultimately, it benefits Real Madrid either from the perspective of a club that now has a player who's gained fantastic experience playing in the Premier League and could come back to La Liga and play at a high level for them if they see a role in the team for him, or it increases his value. We knew that. You know that when you loan a player, that this is a possibility. You know? How much would I pay for him? I mean, I'd pay whatever it took to get Partey, at least. I mean, he's got 2 years left on his deal at Real Madrid, so maybe if they've got a Raul Sanyehi of their own who says you've got to do the deals 2 years out, they have a decision to make. I think we spoke about this the other day. You know, we do have some advantage in that he's here with us. And if he likes it, and if he likes the team and he likes the club and he likes the manager and he likes what we could sell him, you know, in terms of look at what you could become for this team. Look at the kind of player you could become, you know, pivotal to Arsenal Football Club. If that's something that floats his boat, then, you know, we could potentially make something happen. But of course, the better he plays, the more eyes are going to be on him, the more we're going to be talking about him, the more Madrid are going to want for him and all the rest. But that's just something you have to contend with. It's kind of a risk that you take.
It's the price of success of the loan, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Like, is the loan... Did Edu and Arteta do this loan deal simply to give us something for 6 months? Or did they do this loan deal to give us something for 6 months, or that they thought they could get for 6 months, but also to lay the groundwork for a player that they want to bring in on a permanent basis? Yeah. I would hope it's the latter. You know what I mean? Because the quality that Odegaard has is indisputable. So, you know, the idea that it's just like, well, we only ever wanted him for 6 months anyway, he can go back to Real Madrid, you know, doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, I think we probably need to, you know, launch a letter writing campaign. You know, dear Zinedine Zidane.
Never mind that, what a crowdfunder, probably.
Well, that too, but like, dear Zidane, I'm sorry to tell you this, but despite the fact that Martin Odegaard appears to be playing very well for Arsenal, he's just an absolute bollocks off the pitch. He's a bad, bad boy. He's very naughty. And nobody likes him, and he smells, and really saying weird things about you and your head. He says your head is weird and hairless, and he doesn't like you, and he doesn't like Spain or Madrid, and actually he's got a tattoo that says I love Barcelona right across his chest. So, you know, probably you don't want to be dealing with this guy anymore. We'll take that responsibility for you. We'll do you a solid here and we'll take him off your hands. That kind
very
of shit.
Charitable of us.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. Zidane's probably not the one we need to be writing to because he didn't pick him, you know, this season. I think he started 3 La Liga games. And it is a really complex situation at Madrid, as far as I understand it, because Zidane's own future is in some doubt.
Mm.
It looks like Madrid might get pipped to the title by Atletico, which won't go down very well. But Florentino Perez, the club president, has always been a really big proponent of Odegaard and always seen him as part of the future of the club. So if there is a managerial change, that could play into Odegaard's hands if he wants to go back to Madrid and be a star there. However, on the other side of the coin, Madrid are in a nightmarish financial situation. I mean, as bad as it is for English clubs, for Barcelona and Madrid, it is at another level. I think Swiss Ramble estimated or wrote that they had lost, were go set to lose like €400 million over the two seasons of coronavirus.
Yeah, but what they'll probably do is just sell an acre of land, you know, to one of the banks.
To the king.
And the king will give them £1 trillion and
it never seems to affect them.
You know?
But if they do, you know, need to fund a rebuild, I mean, I'll be honest, I'm not hugely optimistic just because Madrid do need to kind of renovate their squad slightly, and a bit like us with Saliba, they'd be kind of crazy to not make Odegaard part of that.
Different situation in that, you know, they didn't pay a huge amount for Odegaard because they got him when he was very young, right?
True.
So it's not quite that. And if they do have their beady little eyes set on somebody like Haaland or Mbappe or something like that, which, you know, is pretty likely considering the way that Real Madrid operate, you know, if they could be convinced to sell, knowing that it would give them some funds to add to what they could bid for one of the big players in the world, because that's really what they want. That's what their, you know, that's what their foundations are, in a way, is bringing in, particularly in Madrid, is bringing in these, you know, massive stars.
The Galacticos.
So, you know, there is the possibility of it. And like I say, we need to lay the groundwork as much as possible with Odegaard himself. It's clear Arteta really likes him. It's clear he sees him as a key part of his team right at this moment. You know, But, you know, you know, it's not a wishy-washy Denis Suarez loan, this, you know?
No, and by the way, I think that's been a little bit overlooked, how impressive it is to come into a new league and a new team at the midway point in the season and immediately establish yourself and immediately be producing these kinds of performances.
Mm.
I think that's really impressive on Odegaard's part. And I suppose the appeal of Arsenal, I mean, look, unlike Madrid, we're not going to be a Champions League club. We're not going to, in all likelihood, be contesting the title next season. But, you know, against West Ham, this looked like Odegaard's team. And he is absolutely the main man on the creative front at the moment.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of a little bit optimistic that his recent appointment as Norway international captain might just make him think, look, I need to play. You know, I need to be playing regular football.
Like he needs to be an important player in whatever team he's playing for. Like he could go to Real Madrid and maybe he could be an important player there. But at Arsenal, you look at him as essentially first name on the team sheet player right now. And how quickly that's happened is a real credit to him.
But in terms of the price, I think you're right to mention the Thomas Partey price. I can't see, given his age, given his potential, very difficult to see how you would get away with paying less than £40 million or something like that.
And that's going to be
unless the market's
difficult.
Completely shot, you know. But where the hell do Arsenal find that money?
Yeah, well, look, there are players who could go. When you think about what we could sell this summer, Guendouzi could go, Maitland-Niles could go, Torreira could go. Could/should in all of those cases, you know what I mean? There are other players who could generate funds. And I think your point, going back to Saliba, is spot on. about using the resources that we have. We cannot afford to not or to waste the £28 million we spent on Saliba. You know, we have to prioritize the areas of the team, and we do need to sign defenders, you know, or bring in a defender or sort out that defensive side of things. But similarly, you know, the idea of, like, we could not have done what we did yesterday against West Ham without Martin Odegaard. And if we'd played well and won the game, we probably couldn't have done it without Martin Odegaard either, if we cut out those defensive mistakes. So, you know, we had a question. It was from Brian Richards on Twitter, who's at BrainRichards99, who says, Odegaard, is keeping him our number one priority this summer? I don't think it's our number one priority per se, but it's certainly important that we try our best to make it happen if it's at all possible, because, you know, from what we've seen and from the influence he's had and the impact he's had in a short period of time, I just would like to see this guy in an Arsenal shirt for years, you know?
I think it might be our number one priority.
Yeah, it could be.
I mean, the other thing about him is he's the right age. Like,
exactly,
as an investment, it makes a lot of sense. You know, I don't really like to talk about players in terms of resale value, but he would have it. And yeah, I think it could be quite important for the development of this team if we're able to convince him to move to Arsenal. I think it would be, I just think, sort of, you know, imagine taking him out of the side and sort of starting again on that front. I mean, you've got Emile Smith Rowe.
Yeah, yeah.
But you've still got a kind of pretty big gap in that area of the park, and they are different types of players. And why not have both?
Well, yeah,
please,
exactly.
Can we have both?
Why not have both? You know, you need those options, and you need that depth in terms of quality. So, like, there's a million reasons why Arsenal should do their best to make that happen.
Yeah, and I guess what I would say is, although these numbers sound daunting, it's not Nicola Pepe money. It's not 100 million. It's not an infeasibly unrealistic, you know, maybe it is a bit unrealistic in the current climate, but it's not such a huge kind of albatross sum of money that's going to hang around like a millstone around our neck. I think it's a deal that would make a lot of sense for Arsenal. I think the bigger question is if it makes sense for Odegaard, and that's the decision that we want to get.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as much as we can convince him by talking, we need to convince him by, you know, he's going to be an ambitious player as well. And there is, I think, something slightly romantic about the idea of being part of, you know, a new generation or a rebuild at a club, whatever it might be. But, you know, at the same time, there's only so much a player, like, if he has to keep bailing us out because we keep making defensive mistakes, you know what I mean? We have to convince him that the team can make the kind of progress that we all want to make as well. You know, that it's not just going to be good 1 week, not great the next week, firefighting another week. Oh, look, we've set our own balls on fire again. Oh, shit. You know, there has to be more from the manager and the way that he produces consistency with the team as well. So, look, here's one from Joe Patch, who's at Boring Joe Patch, who says, are you worried about Leno? Seems to be edgy with the ball at his feet and no real competition for a starting place. Not convincing with crosses in the air either, etc., etc. Yeah. What's your hot Leno take?
Yeah. It's an interesting one, that. I think, how can I put it? I'm a bit disappointed in his recent form, but it would be an exaggeration to say I was especially worried about him. I think he has had a shaky period, but I think you've got to look at that in context. And I think generally he has, until very recently, been largely good this season. And I have faith that he will recover from this slightly shaky patch. What about you?
I don't disagree with any of that. I think he does need to improve his form. It has been a bit iffy of late. I just have some concerns about his passing and his playing out from the back.
Mm.
I think, I wonder if that's going to be a bigger issue than we might think for Arteta.
I think it
Arteta.
Might be a bigger issue, yeah, than I would like it to be. I think Arteta... Well, listen, look, we know how dogmatic some of these coaches can be, and we know how important, I think, that aspect of the game is to Arteta. It wouldn't surprise me if he was prepared to sacrifice other aspects of Leno's game for someone who was more adept with the ball at his feet. That wouldn't surprise me enormously.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And then I'm thinking of all the goalkeepers that City went through because they could play with the ball at their feet.
Claudio Bravo,
you know?
etc.
And then they found a guy who can play but also has the right size, you know, to be a top-level goalkeeper.
Yeah.
Because, you know, obviously we're thinking of David Raya here as somebody who they like. I'm worried that any recommendation from that goalkeeping coach based on previous recommendations is not convincing. And the other thing is he's not that big. He's just not that. He's kind of Ospina-sized, isn't he?
Yeah, I'm not sure he's 6 foot. And I don't think he's had quite the season this year as he did last time. You know, I don't know if that's to do with the speculation or of his future or anything like that, but I don't think he's playing quite as well as he was last season.
Mm. Yeah, anyway, well, it's certainly one to keep an eye on. Yeah,
I mean, look, it wouldn't be top of my list in the summer. Talking about summer priorities, you know, I'm pretty happy with Bernd Leno, I have to say.
Yeah, it wouldn't be top of my list either, but I do think he needs to... Yeah, hopefully the international break will be... he's going away with Germany, I think. So maybe just a chance to refocus and everything else. Because I think generally he has been good.
I think so. Yeah. And, you know, in the first half of the season, we were all saying, you know, how fantastic he was. And he bounced back so well from kind of the Emi Martinez debate. And I think I'm optimistic he'll recover that. But this is... I don't want to keep making excuses for players, but this is just such a weird season. And I do think the mental fatigue might be...
Well, actually, there was a question on the Discord, and just while I find it, I was just going to ask you, you know, Lacazette afterwards said we didn't respect the game plan. Do you think there's any correlation between the amount of times Bernd Leno kicked it long in the first half and his comments about not respecting the game plan? And Nobel94 on the Discord says, evening gents, fatigue has been discussed a lot lately, especially in regard to players like Luis, Saka and Xhaka, but the player with the most minutes never gets a mention, Bernd Leno. Has the mental aspect of his position been overlooked lately? His decision-making and focus have been below his best lately. I can't help think we should have been resting him in the Europa League fixtures and letting Matty Ryan play. The interloper will provide him rest, but is it now too late? So, I mean, do you think that is potentially a factor?
I think that's a really good point. Yeah, I think it is a huge kind of load on a player. And even though maybe physically it's not quite as demanding as other positions, mentally it certainly is. And the degree of concentration that's required, the degree of focus, the degree of pressure. You know, pressure as a goalkeeper is huge. And especially when you make a couple of errors, I mean, that really ramps up. So I think that's a really astute point. What was the first... question?
Well, it was about the correlation between not respecting the game plan and kicking long. I mean, do you think that...
Yeah, I mean, there were interesting things happening in the early period of the game. It did seem like we were almost playing... You know, Chambers was almost tucked in as kind of a third centre-half, and Tierney was playing extremely high in the first 15 minutes, higher than he even normally does. I do think there was a kind of something to our shape, and I think this probably plays into Aubameyang being on the right, as it were, that we were supposed to be doing that we just didn't manage to pull off. As for Leno's distribution, I'd have to look closer at that. I couldn't tell you from memory, you know, if it seemed like he was going. Did he seem to be going longer to you?
Yeah, in the first half in particular, there were a number of occasions where, you know, we kicked it long and we didn't really have an outlet. You know?
Yeah, could be part of it. I find it really interesting that, you know, I think Mikel Arteta is, how can I put it? His credibility as Arsenal manager, I think, is still open to debate and is the subject of debate, I think, among a lot of Arsenal fans. But I think one of the things that lends him the most strength in some ways, in my view, is how quick and how ready his players are to throw themselves under the bus. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like in a post-match environment,
yeah,
the players are so quick to say, this isn't on the manager, it's on us. It's unusual, I think.
Yeah, well, look, let me just ask you this then, because it's slightly tied into it. It comes from the Discord as well, from Mr. CJ Wright, who says, are we starting to see a more ruthless side of Arteta? In recent weeks, we've seen Willian not feature as much as at the start. Bellerin rotated out with Chambers and Cedric. Aubameyang punished for being late last week and hooked off yesterday for a poor performance, whereas under normal circumstances, he would have stayed on. Is this the kind of style that will hopefully get the best out of the rest of the team? Is that a positive for you?
I think there's always been a ruthlessness to him, to be honest. I mean, if you look at his treatment of players like Guendouzi or Mesut Ozil, I'm sure there are others. I think there's always been...
Socrates,
yeah. He's always been prepared to make seemingly quite difficult decisions.
Even playing Willian at times was a difficult decision.
Yeah, and I wonder if maybe the difference is that the kind of usual suspects in terms of the people who found themselves on the wrong side of Arteta have largely moved on. So we're now seeing that same reasoning applied to a smaller group, and therefore some of it stands out as more of a surprise. But I think there's always been a ruthlessness there. Maybe it's not always been evenly applied, but I think that he's always had that streak to him. And personally, it's something I like, because I would be lying if I said, you know, in the final years of Arsene Wenger, that I didn't feel like Arsenal was sometimes too comfortable an environment. And I think having someone who's prepared to make things a bit abrasive and a bit difficult, is probably quite a helpful thing.
Yeah,
for the club.
I totally agree. I think, you know, the Aubameyang situation last week is one of those, and it's not to relitigate it, but that's a big decision and a brave decision on North London Derby Day. That if you don't win, it comes back to bite you in the arse. But if you're committed to, you know, changing the culture and applying the, like, from the outside, there are certain things that we look at and think, well, certain players get different things and everything else. You know, we don't know everything about everything that goes on. It just looks that way from the outside. But if you're dropping your captain, your best goal scorer on the day of a derby, it does show a commitment to the culture that you're trying to instill and everything else. I suppose the one thing I would say is that having options makes it easier to be ruthless.
True.
You know? So the better your squad, the easier it is to make what appear to be ruthless decisions, you know? Mm-hmm. Like if your options are Aubameyang and Lacazette, then that certainly makes it easier than if your option is Aubameyang and Kaba Diawara, for example.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
So building a squad and building a group of players that allows you, when you need to be or when you feel like it or when a player merits ruthlessness, in inverted commas, makes your job an awful lot easier, you know?
Yeah, so absolutely.
I guess that's part of, I hate to use the phrase, the process or whatever it is, but part of what's going on is rebuilding this squad. And hopefully he gets to a point where he can, you know, make difficult decisions with the safety net of having good players to fill the gaps that he needs to fill, you know?
I think, I mean, an example of that ruthlessness maybe is, unless there's some injury problem I don't know about, the exclusion of Hector Bellerin from the squad yesterday. You know, he's been an important player for a long time at Arsenal, but Arteta couldn't find a place for him in the matchday squad. And yeah. I guess that was because he picked Chambers and he thought, well, I'm going to take Cedric because he can play left back as well, and it gives me that extra bit of cover.
Well, exactly, yeah. And I don't think it's necessarily a dismissal of Hector Bellerin because he played in both the Olympiakos games.
No. But it's born out of, like you say, it's a ruthlessness born out of competition. And there are a lot of areas of this team where it is close between players. You know, it is. There are a lot of battles for places that are quite fine margins.
Correct. And like in some cases, it's because the quality isn't there.
Yeah. You know? In some places, it's because performances have dipped from, you know, players who were previously clear first choices.
Yeah.
So there are different reasons for that, but it kind of, I think it creates that effect of ruthlessness.
Sure.
On the subject of ruthlessness and dropping players, I mean, there are a lot of questions about Aubameyang. I mean, Masoud Jaffer on Twitter said, am I mad in thinking we should maybe leave Aubameyang out of the starting 11? Joseph Petrassi, do you think Alba should be dropped and should earn his place back? Les on Twitter even asking, hi guys, could we and would you sell Aubameyang this summer? I suppose let's start with the should we drop Aubameyang thing. Do you think that's a conversation worth having at this point? Well, we're going to have it anyway. So
we are. I mean, do you drop him? Look, I think the thing is, right, that whenever a player goes through a difficult period, there's a tendency to jump to, A, the worst case scenario, and people take these definitive positions which don't allow for any discussion or nuance or anything like it. Like, I saw a lot of people over the last couple of weeks saying, Aubameyang just doesn't care. He doesn't care anymore. We gave him the contract.
Yeah, where's that
he
coming
doesn't
from?
Care. Right? And I don't see that. Personally, I just don't see it. Like, you could say, well, if he cared, he'd turn up on time for the derby. But like, okay, he got caught in traffic, and I'm not excusing him or anything like it. He has a responsibility as the captain of the club to be there. But is it because he doesn't care? I don't believe that. He had some bad games lately where he didn't take the chances. I mean, did he look like a guy when he missed the chances against Olympiakos who was like, ah, fuck it, who cares? No,
yeah.
He didn't. He didn't look like that. He looked like a guy who was really pissed off that he didn't score the goals that he wanted to score. When we scored the third goal yesterday, as he was, you know, making his way around the back of the pitch, did he look like a guy who didn't care? Did he just keep walking? Or did he go like, oh my God, he celebrated with Lacazette and Martinelli? You know, so this idea that he doesn't care anymore, I just don't get it. Should we drop him? I think there's probably an argument that he's got to play his way back into the team. You know, and Lacazette did really well yesterday. I think the system, I think what we shouldn't do is sort of shoehorn him into the team on the right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that was wrong. I would have liked to have seen Aubameyang start up front yesterday. But because of the little injury to Smith Rowe, and because we couldn't have that technical player on the left, he kind of fudged his team selection, Arteta, and we've talked about it already. So
he could have picked Pepe, of course.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, he could have picked Pepe on the right-hand side. Again, though, not necessarily the technical player. You know what I mean? I don't think, it's not to say Pepe doesn't have technical skills, but
skillful, but maybe not a retention.
A bit more,
player,
exactly, yeah. A bit more of a final third secure maverick, player. If you like. So look, you know, when he's not scoring goals and he's a striker, you're under the spotlight and you're 31 years of age, you've got the big contract and all of those things come into play. I still think our best setup is with those three technical players behind Aubameyang. That's what I think. Again, to take nothing away from Lacazette and the way that he played yesterday. And if you play those three technical players behind Lacazette and he scores goals, then good. And if you play those three technical players behind Aubameyang and he scores goals, then good. I don't think you can have sacred cows anymore. You know, if you're trying to instill that culture. And if Aubameyang's form is not great, then his position as captain shouldn't make him undroppable. I don't think that's true. And when Lacazette plays the way that he played against West Ham, then it's good for the team and it's good for competition. But I still think that the most effective attacking lineup we have involves Aubameyang as the center forward. And people can talk all they want about his hold-up play and his link play and all that kind of stuff. And maybe Lacazette does it better, but, you know, Lacazette doesn't go through on goal against Olympiacos the way Aubameyang did, right?
No.
Maybe, you know, they're different players that give you different things as center forwards. And my preference, my personal preference would be for Aubameyang at this moment in time.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of kind of recency bias. I mean, Aubameyang has not scored in his last three appearances, but prior to that, he was on a run of, you know, six goals in six games.
Yeah.
Granted, three of them were a hat-trick against Leeds, but in that little period of games, he probably could have scored more than that because he was getting a lot of chances. I mean, we mentioned the Benfica match as one of those. As I said in part one, I think Arsenal found something in terms of getting Aubameyang firing, playing through the middle, and given the contract he's on, given how effective he can be as a goal scorer, I really wouldn't be kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater at this point. You know, it's Liverpool next in our very next game.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's every chance he starts that game, centre forward.
And look at the go ahead.
No, all I was going to say is, as someone who has been in the past a quite a big proponent of playing Aubameyang from the left-hand side, the way the team is playing now, the way that we've changed our setup, the way in which we transition differently, we're more of a possession-based team, I'm not sure there's any great need to be doing that. And I think in the likes of Saka, Smith Rowe, Pepe, maybe even to an extent Willian, I think we have a different quality of wide player, a different type of wide player that is more useful to us in build-up. And for me, the choice at the moment is between Lacazette and Aubameyang.
Yeah, and Lacazette has three goals in 10 games, his last 10 appearances. You know, so he was very good, et cetera, but it's not as if, you know, he's been banging them in week after week after week after week. And that's not to be critical. That's just to sort of point out what the players have been doing. I mean, there was a question also on Twitter, Dean at DJ Stanners. If you only had to keep one of Lacazette or Aubameyang for next season, who would you choose?
I'd choose Aubameyang.
Yeah, me too.
Still.
Yeah.
And I actually think Lacazette has had a pretty decent season. He's had bad moments, but I think he's been better than he was last year. I think he's been effective at times. He's been a really good foil. I don't think he's quite as bad a player as some make out, but Aubameyang is a proven elite goal scorer. I think that's quite a straightforward decision.
Yeah, and I think
the reality is that's what's happening anyway.
Yeah, and there's a decision to be made about Lacazette in the summer, and if good form between now and May increases his value, then that's kind of where we need to go with it, you know?
Yeah, and I think I sort of have this sense with Lacazette, even yesterday, like I thought he did brilliantly against West Ham, but I think there are other players who could do that. within Arsenal's reach and who maybe even are more suited to it than Lacazette. And as for the question of would I sell Aubameyang, I just don't think that's even on the table as a possibility. And I say that because partly because of the money that we've put him on and the contract we've put him on. I don't foresee someone swooping in to take that over from us at this point.
Yeah.
So again, that's another sort of added piece of motivation to make it work with him.
Yeah, I mean, there's a Khalil Kearns, who's at Lord Akil, Lord Cahill, on Twitter, says, I love Aubameyang. I have his name on the shirt I got this season, but is there something to read into the fact that our three best performances of the season, Chelsea 3-1, Leicester 3-1, and Spurs 2-1, all came without Aubameyang playing?
Maybe. I mean, I mentioned it earlier, but I also think, granted, they were terrible, but we had a brilliant attacking display against West Brom. And Aubameyang did play in that, but
didn't score.
Didn't score, and Lacazette played centrally. And I actually saw somewhere, and I'm sorry because I can't quote it, I don't have it to hand, but that there is some stats that suggest that Lacazette does lead to kind of the general creation of chances, maybe more like his I don't know, his XA or something like that. I don't know. But then there have been so many games of late. I just think recently we seem to have found something with Aubameyang that had kind of clicked, and I don't want to disregard that.
He's just got to find his shooting boots again.
Yeah. I mean, listen, he should have scored a couple of goals in the week, shouldn't he, against Olympiacos?
He should have scored against Benfica. And, you know, there are...
He should have scored against Benfica. Yeah. His finishing's maybe not been quite at the level... Certainly not at the level it was last season. Last season, he was scoring chances he had no right to take, you know? He was kind of outperforming the chances that were provided to him. That this season, not so much. But that'll level out over time.
Yeah.
I still think that the centre forward question is an interesting one, and you know where Martinelli fits in that discussion, for example.
Exactly. I think you know that's something we've talked about before, and you know I'm not necessarily sure that, and you've made this point either, that the two centre forwards Mikel Arteta has at his disposal are his ideal.
No, I'm not convinced of that at all.
You know, so what we do in terms of the training groundwork put into Martinelli or what we might do in the transfer market this summer is going to be very, very, very interesting, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
You got one more?
Do you know what? Most of the ones I had, you've actually already asked me. Great minds think alike.
Okay. I'm trying to think, do I've got one more?
Oh, I've got one here, actually.
Yeah?
Just from Ashley Birkinshaw, says, would you agree Kieran Tierney just didn't seem focused yesterday? Mentally, he's usually so sharp. Yesterday's head looked down. Is this perhaps the result of the hard schedule?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
It was his worst game for a while, I would say, Kieran Tierney.
Yeah, look, he was culpable for the second goal. One of the players culpable for the second goal.
He does make a great block in the second half.
Yeah. True. Look, he's played a lot of football. We don't have a backup left back. We're asking an awful lot of him. So if he is tired physically and mentally, again, I'm not excusing it, but I understand it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like this one from Eddie Longbridge, at Eddie Longbridge. Should Mikel Arteta consider hiring a hypnotherapist to make Mikel Arteta believe we are 3-0 down before the kickoff? He'll be angry and frustrated, and the pre-game team talk will ensure we go out and win the match with ease. So.
It's an idea.
Yeah.
We're getting a lot of angry Mikel after games at the present time.
Mm.
But... yeah, be good if he could do whatever's needed before, just to make sure the
would
team
be handy.
Right frame of mind.
Just that very finally, nice. Very finally, from the Discord, Wiltshire Gooner says, was the substitution of Xhaka and Aubameyang significant beyond the context of this single match? We've kind of touched on Aubameyang already, but what about Smith Rowe for Xhaka?
I think that's interesting. I mean, we ended up doing something a bit similar to what we did at Villa Park in the final stages, with kind of, you know, Smith Rowe slightly off to the left and Odegaard to the right in almost a kind of midfield three, you know, almost the Man City way of playing with kind of two number eights. Maybe there is something in that in the future. I definitely think both players are capable of doing those jobs. But I think in terms of bringing Xhaka off, I think that was probably just about minutes at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, he has clocked up some miles.
Some fresh legs. But I thought it was an interesting change as well, you know, to play or to put Smith Rowe in kind of that area. Maybe there's something there that augurs for the future. But I think really it was in the context of the game. It was getting fresh legs on somebody with the ability to pick a pass, to run with the ball a bit as well, which isn't necessarily what Xhaka can do. Okay, well, look, I know you have to go, and we've been talking a long time today about that crazy game. So thank you to everyone for sticking with us, as always. We really, really appreciate it. It is the Interlull, but we'll be doing plenty of stuff for you during the Interlull over on the Patreon. If you want to sign up, patreon.com/arseblog. The usual podcast schedule will apply as well, so we'll have something for you this Friday. In the meantime, take it easy. Hope Arsenal haven't wrecked your head too much. Well, how can they not? That's what they do. But anyway.
Sorry that Arsenal have wrecked your heads so much.
Sorry that I couldn't find any words of comfort and solace for you at this difficult time. I really do apologize. All right, look, we'll leave it there. We'll catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.